That's the sound of wrestling legend Dan Gable winning his gold medal. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Dan Gable has experienced triumphs most of us can only dream of. He's also been touched by all too real tragedy. This hour, I'll talk with him about his remarkable career as a wrestler and a coach and his life. We'll talk about his childhood, discovering a passion for wrestling, losing his sister, winning the gold, and deciding when it was time to step away. Stories told in his new book, A Wrestling Life, The Inspiring Stories of Dan Gable. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. For most Iowans, Dan Gable is a household name. Wrestling fans started talking about him when he was a state champion in high school. Buzz grew through his remarkable college career at Iowa State University. And then the world found out about Dan Gable when he won his gold medal in 1972. After that came a legendary career as the head coach at the University of Iowa. Dan Gable has shared his stories in the new book, A Wrestling Life, The Inspiring Stories of Dan Gable, co-written with Scott Schulte, and he is here in the studio with me today. Hello, Dan.
Glad to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And I want to start way back when you were a kid growing up in Waterloo. You share some very, very funny stories about your early childhood. You were a bit of a spitfire there at the beginning.
Well, I'm a little hellion. it's still in me, but somehow I got tamed down a little bit. And by that, I'm saying parents put me in the right place. And they realized that early on that this kid needed some structure. And they were doing it at home, but not well enough. So they sent me down to the YMCA. And that was like as early as 4 years old.
Wow.
So, you know, I started getting some pretty good coaches, per se, and a lot of people that were really directing my life. And when I was out of line, they would keep me in line. So I was pretty lucky. A lot of people are born into something that if you're a hellion, you're going to be a hellion your whole life. And I could turn it on the mat, but then I'd have to turn it off when I got off the mat.
Well, there are a lot of people who, when they talk about swim team for young kids, talk about the fact, well, it keeps them tired. And I can imagine that your parents, maybe that's one of the reasons they sent you to the pool, is just keep him tired. Then he can't get into trouble.
You know, I never thought about it that way. And you know what? I don't think that's probably what they were thinking. My parents were very competitive for me right away. They wanted me to do well. And so I think they really had some sights that were way beyond what my sights were at that time. And they just, you know, they got me in a YMCA swim program. And that was my competitive spirit coming out of me, and we had a lot of competition there and did well early on, learned to swim, which is really important in everybody's life. But I also, at the YMCA, I was playing ping pong. We had a pool table down there. I learned to be social with people. I actually had to learn the hard way a couple fist fights, but you know, and then I got my first job there. I think it was 35 cents an hour, and that was, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 hours a week. You might pick up $2-3, and that was big back then. You know, and so I had a really good time every day. I mean, it was every day. It was probably 7 days a week if it was open. I think it was. And so I had some time there, and when I'd get home, I could unwind a little bit, but didn't take me long to unwind.
You also found early on that you really had a competitive fire. And you write about when you were swimming competitively as a kid, how hard it was for you to lose. Did you ever get comfortable with that?
No. I don't think people should get comfortable with losing. That doesn't mean that you don't analyze it and you figure out what's good for you and what went wrong and those type of things. And it doesn't have to be as fanatical as me, unless you want to be. But I think there's a lot to be learned about setting a pattern in leadership, W's over L's, wins over losses. And I look at some of these kids that get on these mats early on at an early age, and I don't know how their parents can keep them on that mat when they get on a losing streak. And you know what? The thing, when the parents keep them on the mat, that's the thing to do. They're eventually going to get their hand raised. And if they don't, that's because they're probably at a disadvantage some way. It could be, everybody wrestles. I mean, we got kids that wrestle with one arm, no legs. I mean, you know, it's just, you know, some diseases that you wouldn't think that we could do it. But most of the time, when they stick it out, there's something to be learned there, not just about winning and losing, but about the spirit of competition. And eventually, it'll help win you over in life. And I really think that my parents weren't perfect by any means. They just looked out for their kids pretty well, and when the flaws that they had weren't really flaws in those days. I mean, they were smoking all the time. I mean, nobody told them that.
Everybody was.
Yeah, and they both passed on early because of those traits, but they quit, you know, once they had a few bouts with cancer and stuff like that. But and they were drinking. Waterloo was a pretty crazy town. They had a lot of companies there that people had to work pretty hard, and I think it was more of the sign of the times back in those days. And it was really do as I say and not do as I. I mean, they could do as they wanted to do, and right. I shouldn't say anything wrong. It's harder today. I think when kids look at people today, you got to back up what you're saying. They don't just believe you if you don't have that good life.
Was your sister an athlete?
Not really. She was before Title IX quite a few years. I don't know if too many girls competed. I mean, maybe there was I think basketball was going on in the state of Iowa maybe when she was growing up, girls basketball. But I don't believe we had too many opportunities for the females back in those days. And I just think that they did other things, you know, and she really just followed me in whatever I did, just like my mom and dad. So it was kind of part of the family to there was a male in the family that was a good sport. That's you kind of followed him and cheered him on.
That's what you focused on. Yeah. Right. When did you discover wrestling?
Oh, right away.
Really?
Yeah, right away. I was born into wrestling. Not only just with my family, my dad being a wrestler, but my dad wasn't a great wrestler. But his friends were great wrestlers. The Waterloo Cedar Falls community was great wrestling when I was growing up, and not only at the high school level. I mean, there's three legendary coaches in that area at that time. In my high school, West Waterloo, it was Bob Siddons. At East Waterloo, there was Dave Natvig. And in Cedar Falls High School, there was Keith Young. And those three are legendary people in the sport of wrestling. And both Siddons and Young wrestled at the University of Northern Iowa, which I don't know if it was called SCI then or State Teachers College, but they wrestled there. And Keith Young was like a three-time national collegiate champion. In fact, the University of Northern Iowa won a national collegiate championship back a long time ago. But my high school coach, Bob Siddons, is still at the top of the list in the state tournaments. And he hasn't been coaching for, you know, 30, 40 years. And he's still won more state titles and he's still around. He's going to turn 90 this year.
Wow.
And he will celebrate his birthday and he's still swimming laps. I think he'll do 90 laps on his birthday in a pool. But everybody tried wrestling in Waterloo and Cedar Falls. And then might not stay there, but those three coaches. I think that's a good sign of a really good leader that the parents, and when all of a sudden even though everybody can't make the team, but everybody's going to get something out of that program. And so every parent wanted their kid, their son, to be a part of the program. I know when I was there, we had a good-sized room, but we had to put mats outside the room for the extra people that were on the team. And we were winning state championships. East Waterloo was winning state championships. Cedar Falls was close. I don't know how many state championships they won, but I'm just rubbing it in a little bit, knowing that you're from Cedar Falls.
Yeah. Right. Your dad loved to tell a story about when he says he realized you were going to be a great wrestler. Can you tell us what he used to say to people about when you were a baby?
Well, he says when I came home from the hospital, if I was born in a hospital, which I know, they tell me I was. In those days, you never know. But Ellen Hospital, I believe. So we didn't have a very nice home early on. You know, we didn't have a lot of money at the beginning. Probably never did have a lot of money. But he claims when I first got home and he put me in this crib, that they heard me crying and they come in. And it was like, wow, this kid's bridging. This kid's he's on his back, but he's trying to get off his back already. And I mean, it's right within the first, you know, this is my dad's folklore,
right,
but he says he was wrestling right there on that mattress within the first week when he got home from the hospital, and he wasn't going to get pinned. He didn't like being on his back, so he wanted to get off his back right away. And he said it was so cold in the house that I kind of like my whatever, I was crying or whatever, it was like I had frozen eye water, but you know, they feed me full of little BS too, so.
Every family has legends. I'm sure yours has maybe a few more than the rest of us. As you did all of these different sports, was there a time that you decided that wrestling was going to be it? Do you remember when that moment was?
Yeah, I do remember the moment. It was actually as late as 10th grade. During my era, in the school, larger schools, 10th, 11th, and 12th was high school. In some of the smaller schools, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th, or they even, if they were 10th, 11th, and 12th, they were able to bring up 9th graders to be a part of the program for wrestling.
All right, and you know what? We're going to have, this is our preamble to that story, that moment, because we have to take a short break.
Yeah.
We'll be back in just a moment. We'll find out what it was in 10th grade that helped you realize that wrestling was your focus. I'm talking with wrestling legend Dan Gable. He shares his stories in the new book, A Wrestling Life, The Inspiring Stories of Dan Gable, co-written with Scott Schulte. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Dan Gable, wrestling legend. We're talking about his childhood. We'll talk about his remarkable high school career and college career, winning that gold medal in 1972, coaching at the University of Iowa. He shares his stories in the new book, A Wrestling Life, The Inspiring Stories of Dan Gable. And just before the break, I asked you when you realized that wrestling was it for you. And you said it was in 10th grade. What was it that made you have that epiphany?
Well, wrestling before that was kind of my favorite, just because it was the most natural, and it was the only time that I really got overtaken by the sport where I wasn't thinking. I was just doing it. And it wasn't any time to, like, be in the huddle or in between pitches or going out of bounds. Well, you know, I guess you could go out of bounds. But, you know, it's just one of these things that when I got home at night after a wrestling practice, wow, it was just like I could relax the rest of the night because I was so spent. But I think it was my sophomore year, and I was actually a starting spin back. And you probably don't know what a spin back is in football, but it's kind of like the quarterback. He gets the snap from the center. but it was a different different formation. And back in those days, they had a single wing formation. And our coach in junior high ran the single wing, and so they would, the center would snap me the ball about 4 or 5 yards behind the center, and I'd have a tailback on one side of me, a wing back on another, and a blocking back on another. So, you know, it was kind of like a shotgun. You know, again, I'm talking football terms, but I'd get the direct snap, I'd hand off to somebody or fake it and or pass it or run it. So, you know, and I was always the starter. So the football really figured that I should play football. And the problem was that I wasn't very big. And by that I'm saying wrestling starts back in those days at the 95-pound level. Now it's a 106. They just don't have anybody at 95 anymore. It's just it's probably too light a weight. There's a few maybe. But all of a sudden when I went to the first football meeting, which was in August, when I looked around, because I was a sophomore, and then there was the varsity was in the meeting too. And I was hitting everybody's waist with my top of my head, and then and then everybody else was like so much bigger than me, and one of the assistant coaches, which was the head wrestling coach, come over to me and he says, "Hey, you know, what do you think? You think you should be a football player right now?" And I said, "Well, I planned on it." He says, "Well, you know, I really need you at that 95-pound spot," and I weighed more than that at the time, but. You know, he was looking to fill his lineup, and he thought that maybe if I went off for football, I'd probably get injured and maybe miss the wrestling season. And wrestling was going to be my best sport. We could tell that already. So he convinced me and that I should still go out for football, but only go to their warm-ups because—
So just to stay in shape?
No.
No?
So I wouldn't go home or I wouldn't leave school at 3:30. And go somewhere else. And even though he didn't know me that well, and that wouldn't have been me, but he was just trying to see how he could keep me engaged. Because, you know, once school's out, and if you're not out for a sport, you know, maybe I'm tired, maybe I, who knows what. But he thought that I'd show up for football practice every day at 3:30 and go through their warm-ups for a half hour and then leave the football and go inside. And there was a mat rolled out, and there was 3 or 4 or 5 guys that were not out for football that were starting, would wrestle and for a half hour, 45 minutes. And he just said, well, if you want to do that, that's an option. Now, the other guys didn't do the warm-ups. They just came. But for some reason, you know, I came every day to the football early on and then went right into wrestling and worked out in wrestling. So I didn't really think at that time that I was going to be a full-time year-round wrestler, but actually when I started doing it and with the success I had right away and being a state champion the first year, it kind of hooked me. Not that I didn't do other things. I had hobbies, you know, fishing and other things, but I really got into that one sport thing at that particular age in my sophomore year, and it was probably a good thing. It was probably a good thing just because, man, I'll tell you what, I'm still not very big, you know. Compared to football players that are kicking some butt today.
Right.
So it would have had to be one of these things where I'd had to miss them. And I don't know if I was fast enough.
This was a time in your life when a lot of things happened. There were a lot of changes that you experienced. I mean, just growing up, but also there was a terrible tragedy that occurred in your life in 1964. And your older sister, Diane, was 19 years old that year. And she was murdered. Can you tell me? You were out of town with your parents, and you tried to call home, couldn't get Diane on the phone. So your dad asked a neighbor to go check on her, and that's when you found out. And your whole family was just so devastated by that news. Your mom was actually so upset she was hurting herself, and you had to drive home knowing what had happened. In the car on the way home, you were thinking back. You were thinking, is there anything that I know that may have something to do with Diane's death? And you actually came up with the key to solving that mystery. And that was a conversation that you'd had with the man who killed her. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I tell you, the way you just laid it out, I'd never really thought about it that way before. And that's as much as the way you laid it out. Yeah, it was a neighbor. You know, it was just all of a sudden. I don't know. It's just being in the back seat of the car and watching two people squirm and drive, and something just hit me. You know, that 3 weeks, a month before, that I was walking to school, and I only had to walk a block, and then all of a sudden, I was in a conversation with another kid that was another neighbor, but who was another block away further than I lived. We happened to just hit up that day, and we really weren't friends, even though we were in the same grade, even though he was older than me. He just all of a sudden said something about wrestling first, because I had just come off a state championship. Hey, you're a pretty good wrestler. You see where you did all right. That's pretty cool, winning that state championship. And, that's the first conversation I think I ever had with the kid, so that probably would have stuck with me too. But then all of a sudden he brought my sister up, who was 3 years older than him, 4 years older than me. And he started talking about qualities that if you knew somebody and you'd been around somebody, he's talking about a girl, you might talk about it, but probably not somebody that was the brother. And you don't have a relationship with a guy, and he just said some very unusual things that were of sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. That, like, well, I just kind of shook my head, but I just let it go because I got friends. We talk about girls, but right. But not in that manner. And because I let it go, I analyzed it later on, just much later on. I mean, when I remember that conversation, I brought it up, and I really had no idea. But we took that lead, and that lead led to his arrest. But what that really did for me in my life is when I'm in conversations and I hear something that is unusual or at least an even type of like a warning or just a conversation meaning mean nothing, I know I followed up a lot on that because of that particular incident. Just because, you go back and you say, what if you would have came home and said something to your parents? And, it's just what if. And
you were only 15 years old, and yeah. Things like that happened. I mean, conversations like that happened. Did you blame yourself? Did you feel like you should have done something? I mean, it changed how you interacted with other people.
I don't think I blamed myself to where, it was like haunting me, but it definitely made me more alert. It made me more understanding of things, and I just act on things probably too much more. And so it's like my wife, my kids, there's a lot of things that as we grew up together and with this new family that they would look at me like, why are you worried about that? Well, it's just one of these things, and they kind of understood later on when they actually read a story about my sister. And
right.
It goes back to that. But I mean, it's like just little things. I mean, it's like they go, why are you making me carry something in the car like a hammer? Mm. And I said, well, in case you go off the road into a lake, right. And you can't get out. And they figured it out later on that, hey, you know what? It's not a bad idea to have that there. You just because you all of a sudden you hear about it. It happens.
Right.
But
and
you
so
gotta,
having it's, four daughters,
yeah.
I'll bet you worried about them a lot, I'll bet.
Well, yeah, but I didn't really have to worry about the boyfriends as much because my wife did a great job there.
Good.
Kathy, they became very scared of her right away, whereas I became their friends kind of. So it's kind of a different situation right. There.
When your sister was killed, you were heartbroken your parents were heartbroken. And in reading about what happened then, I thought about how different things are now. Because when there's a tragedy in somebody's life now, we are often invited to grieve as a community. But then that wasn't the way that it was. And you didn't have a family where you communicated a lot about your feelings. I get that from a number of the stories. And you really, you felt like your parents were falling apart. I mean, in retrospect, did you feel that at the time?
Oh, for sure. No, they were, I mean, whatever was going on before her murder, it escalated, you know, and it wasn't letting up. I thought it would let up after a period of time, but it just didn't seem to be letting up. And all of a sudden, one night in the middle of the night, they were fighting, crashing things around. You know, it was just kind of a typical Waterloo home, but a little extreme on this area. So one time, all of a sudden, my mom was answering a response to my dad, and she let him have it, and the response got me out of bed, and I said, this is it. You know, I just, boom. And for some reason, that house, that bedroom of hers was staying, the door was staying closed, and nobody was being active in it. It was just...
So you're still in the house, and you got them to move back into the house from your grandparents' house, but... That room, nobody.
It was haunted almost, you know, and it's like, so I just looked at him and I said, wow, I'm getting out of my room. I'm moving into that room. It just hit me. It wasn't like I had it planned or anything. It was just a response to a situation that was out of hand in the house, and it was crazy. And they just stopped. Whenever they were doing, they just looked at me and watched me walk into that room that night, and I just opened the door, went in there, and jumped in bed. Wow. And did I go to sleep? I don't think so, but not right away. But they looked in on me, and they didn't say anything to me. And next day, we moved things around and changed my little bedroom into an office. My mother started becoming more active in my dad's business at home and real estate. And so it started working a little bit. And so the house didn't have this one room that was holding us back. I mean, it wasn't easy even with that because my dad, I mean, here's the thing. I think I was able to handle the situation much better than them because after being a parent, I can understand why more than a sibling. I was close to her, but
there's nothing like losing a child.
I could see my dad do some crazy things, and he had some people that were friends that allowed him to do some crazy things. But I never felt like they felt about this guy.
But you felt like you had the weight of your family on your shoulders. You felt like you were the one that had to hold the three of you together.
Yeah, but I was a tough kid. They started me out.
That's you know, still a lot. That is
no,
a lot.
No, I'm telling you, they prepared me pretty good for a lot of things. And so what's kind of interesting is that I know it's the reason why I was like the captains of all the teams that I played on. I know it's the reason why people came to me for, I mean, even teachers sometimes once they saw this kid in high school would call me in after school and give me their problems.
Wow.
And I look at him like, you know, I'm not really a big communicator. I don't talk yet much. But then after he told me, then I usually came up with something for him. So I don't know, something about me that people came for help and I could usually deliver.
You also threw yourself into wrestling. Was that, in retrospect, did you feel like that was the way to hold the family together, was to be the best wrestler there was?
Oh, for sure, but I loved it. I mean, the winning and the success that I was having was, of course, adding on to it, but it was just such a community that appreciated the sport and all the friends, and everybody was following. and everybody just respected me because we had great wrestlers. But then we had this one great wrestler that was me that was like, whoa, he's not doing anything that everybody else is doing. He's not going to prom. He's, you know, he's skipping this. He's going home every night. We're going out partying. But my friends also taught me a few things how to do that too. So it took probably in the middle of my high school year to where actually some people took me under their wings and, hey, there was some things out there besides
lifting
wrestling.
Weights and wrestling in your basement.
Well, you know, they saw where this kid needs a little social life. So they introduced me to girls, maybe a little partying in the woods. You know, it's just a few things that are very little. I mean, maybe three or four times in the spring, and that was it. But I found out that, I'm going to have some fun too. But the fun really wasn't that fun the next day. It was just like my lifestyle was better for the next day.
We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Dan Gable. He shares the stories of his life in the new book, A Wrestling Life, The Inspiring Stories of Dan Gable. We will continue our conversation in a moment. We'll talk about his collegiate career, that one loss, and winning that gold medal. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm here with wrestling legend Dan Gable. He shares the stories of his life in the new book, A Wrestling Life, The Inspiring Stories of Dan Gable. And this hour, we're talking about his life and his career. I want to skip on to your college career. You went to Iowa State University. And again, wrestling was the primary focus of your life. Your career at Iowa State University is legendary. You were almost undefeated. You were undefeated through high school. You were almost undefeated through college. But there was that one match. And with just one loss, do people ask you about that one loss all the time? I mean, there were so many amazing wins, but people must be fascinated.
That's probably the most number one thing they talk about, even though maybe number two might be going unscored on at the Olympic Games. And really, that loss helped me go unscored upon at the Olympic Games. So it's one of those things that you got to kind of take it on. But no, that loss is always in the conversation just because people go undefeated in high school. Not very many people go undefeated in college, but quite a few go in high school. But the two together, nobody's ever done it. And that would have been the one time that somebody did it. So, you know, it's like, yep, I had one opportunity to be the only person and I blew it. But I didn't even realize that at the time. That wasn't on my mind. For some reason, I never thought about the string. And that's why the string kept going, because it wasn't like, oh, my gosh, I won 14 in a row. I'm 14-0. You know, oh my gosh, it's a good record. And all of a sudden, you're 64-0. Now you're 120-0, and you're 150. That never really crossed my mind, even though it was always in the newspaper.
Right.
I don't know if I just overlooked it or read it. I was always focused on the next match and doing a good job, focused on really the next practice, learning more, getting things done that way. So it kept my mind off the pressure type situations, which I really never even thought about anyway. I think a lot of people always wondered how you could keep winning all these things and doing it well and be okay. I mean, not just like going crazy or something, you know. But it was just one of those things that I started thinking about it. And it was right at the end. It was kind of amazing. And would I do anything different? Oh, I'd probably try to do something different, be perfected more than I was, and so I wouldn't have this flaw. But really, didn't I need this flaw for the future? Because if I would have really won that match in a good way, would I have still won the world championships? Would I still go undefeated in like Olympic competition unscored upon? That's where I have my doubts now. I just think that point in time in my life, that loss actually triggered me to higher levels of skill than if I'd have won it. So that's why I went on. That's why I won the Worlds. That's why I won the Olympics. And that's why I won the University of Iowa's won 15 championships, 21 out of 21 Big Ten championships. That loss, along with my sister's loss, you know, it was another loss in coaching. And I always say, well, if you go 10 years without a loss and you have one, that's not too bad. But really, you don't even want one. But I think every once in a while you got to be reminded, because you slip back into little ways of life that aren't as perfected as you would be if you hadn't had those. So every aspect of my life, athlete, coach, tragedy, I've had a loss. But it's not very often.
You write about that loss, and you write about the match in detail. People can read about it in your book. But I want to talk about what happened after the loss, because, well, first of all, everybody was comforting you, and that just made things worse for you. But as you were working through it, there were two people you just could not talk to about it or anything, and that was your parents. What happened?
Well, there was a death in the family, again, from my point of view. It wasn't from their point of view, but I didn't know that, because, you know, you do things for certain reasons. When you have a mother that hardly could be in the same arena and watch you wrestle after a certain point in time, you know there's some meaning there. She'd have to stand outside a lot of times, watch through the window, or even when she was in the arena, it was like my worst nightmare for me was if I was going to lose for her. So, and that would be for her worst nightmare. So, but I didn't really understand that as much as until I lost that match, and then it was like, wow, I've really let her down.
So you felt like you had failed your mother?
Oh yeah, for sure. Well, one reason why is I really did fail in that match, because I didn't prepare for the match the same way I always prepared. And there's several things, and that's a whole, you know, chapter in there and whatever. But it was like, you know, I just didn't do the same things. I just didn't do the same things for that match that I normally did. I kind of took on, well, I'm good enough to win this match, and you're not. You got to be ready every time, because there's somebody out there that could be ready, even if they're not on the same caliber. But this kid was ready to go. But anyway, you know, so it was like when my mother tried to talk to me, it was on by phone mostly. And it was like my throat would get real, real thick. And I've had it happen before, but usually it's something really crazy, you know, that, you know, and so it was just one of those things that all of a sudden, about the third day home, I'd already started my healing a little bit, because I already got back in the room, and one of my good friends wasn't going to wrestle his final match. But
right,
I
talked him into doing it.
Yeah, and so I got him on track. That would have really hurt me too.
Yeah.
And so so then all of a sudden, really in the morning, like 6:30 in the morning, about the third morning at my apartment, somebody rang the doorbell, and I'm the one who answered it, and whoa, there was my mom. And she just looked at me, and I froze again, and she was waiting for me to say something. I didn't say nothing. So there it was, just like on the phone. And so she just hauled off and cracked me across the face. I've been hurt in wrestling practice a lot worse, not more than that. But that was the crack that snapped me out of it. I needed something from my support group, my real close support group. That was my parents. And as soon as she said something, boy, I could talk right to her, and within a matter of minutes, I realized that she's not holding this against me. I'm not letting her down. She's just wanting to talk to me, make sure I'm okay, hug me, tell me she loves me, and wow, just had to get that moment out of the way.
Before we run out of time, I want to fast forward to the Olympics in 1972 in Munich, and we have some audio from that match. This is from ABC television, and we'll listen in.
Dan Gable could only lose the gold if he's disqualified or pinned, and we're in the final 3 minutes of this man who has so dedicated himself to this one thing, a gold medal. Dedication is the name of Dan Gable.
He works out 7 hours a day, 7 days a week. I have never seen such dedication. I was in a training camp with him a year ago for 3 weeks, and he is just unbelievable. Dan has said, wrestling is my life, and his life is on the line tonight. Ashurilyov on the right, Gable, troubled again by an eye, his left eye, which was cut in his opening match. It required 3 stitches. He went on to pin his opponent in that match in the second period. Last February, Dan Gable went to Russia with the U.S. team to wrestle in a big tournament. He was selected the outstanding wrestler at that tournament. At that time, the top wrestling Russian official said, we are going to hunt throughout the Soviet Union to find a man to beat Dan Gable. This is the man, Ashurilyov. 1 minute to go, third period. You better believe the hometown folks of Waterloo, Iowa, are watching this young man. Looking up at the clock, and Dan Gable right now is just less than a half a minute short of a gold medal at 149 and a half pounds. 5 seconds, and you will hear a crowd of Americans who have gathered here to watch this match tonight, and Dan Gable has won the gold medal at 149 and a half pounds. A regular decision for Dan Gable. And in my book, maybe the most dedicated athlete I've ever known.
Dan Gable, what can I say? You dedicated your life to it. You were up there in the stands, and you kissed that gold medal. That meant that much.
I sure did. This is the tops in sports, winning the Olympics, and this is what I've been working for all my life, and I won it, and it's the greatest feeling I've ever had.
Well, Dan, congratulations. Our congratulations. And I know out in Waterloo, Iowa, yeah, the bells are ringing.
I hope so. I'm glad to bring it home.
That was, again, an ABC announcer describing Dan Gable's match for the gold medal at the Munich Olympics in 1972 against Ruslan Ashurilyov of the Soviet Union. And that moment has been talked about so much and seen so many times by so many. It wasn't just Waterloo, Iowa that was going crazy. It was all of Iowa and, of course, all of the United States that was cheering for you and rooting for you. When you listen to that, when you think about that moment, what do you feel?
Oh, that kind of broke me up a little. Because there's a lot of memories, not only with the announcing people and the Olympic Games. And it's just, you know, it was a lot that took place in my life. And it's just like Frank Gifford. I mean, he was the announcer there. Frank Gifford, it started his announcing career, and he gives credit to the wrestling U.S. team for getting all those medals because they didn't think they were going to get a lot of medals, and he wasn't going to get any airtime, and he got a lot of airtime, and he went on to greatness. You know, he was already a great athlete,
but
in announcing, so you know, it's just one of those things. And then you just think about the team, the effect that 72 team, 6 medals. 3 golds, I think 2 silvers and a bronze, 4 from Iowa State that was training at Iowa State, 3 actual Iowa Staters and a brother, the Peterson brothers, Taylor, and myself. So there's a lot of emphasis on our sport. And so, you know, it's just it's unbelievable to listen to that. And, you know, when somebody calls you like the most dedicated athlete they've ever known and they've known a lot of athletes, that's pretty good. And I think what, you know, people don't realize is like, you know, like after the match, this guy saw me, like when I got done, I'd go out for a hard sprint and run and continue to train a little bit.
And you trained the next day. You trained the day after you won the gold medal.
Well, you know, it was just...
A lot of people would take that day off.
Yeah, but I just didn't know how to.
Yeah.
It was something it was a way of life. And I don't think I've taken a day off since then, except for a few surgeries and then I'm trying to rehab myself doing something. But I brought back a lot of memories there. And
you tell this amazing story. It's very funny. That night after you won the gold medal, you misplaced the gold medal.
Well, I put it in my gym bag. So I thought, you know, somebody stole it. But I thought, you know, big deal. Come back, win another one. Get it replaced, but then I find out they don't replace them,
right?
And it's kind of crazy. So you know, I'd have to come back, but you know, at that time, my mother was a little concerned, and so I turned the project over to her. She was a little smarter than me when it came to that stuff. She found it in about 10 minutes. Even though I looked for it for 2 hours and I couldn't find it, she found it right back in that gym bag. It had a false bottom. Oh. And I didn't know what a false bottom was in a gym bag. I mean, it probably could have been a lot of things under there, you know. But she just lifted up that false bottom, and there was that gold medal.
Oh, my goodness. So. But then she wouldn't let you have it back.
No, no. She took it, and she hung it in her house, too. And she didn't let me carry it around very much. Actually, my wife, Kathy, doesn't let me take it very often, even though it's in our house, just because I take it, I put it in my pocket, I show it to kids. Kids put it on, and I might leave it somewhere. I mean, I don't want to leave it there, but, you know, I'm thinking about something else. So that's why I don't get to take it out very often.
I think that's a beautiful story. Mm. We only have a couple minutes left, but there are a couple other moments in your life that were so pivotal. And one is when you decided to stop wrestling, and another is when you decided to stop coaching. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of reasons that you made those decisions. But the number one reason that you decided to stop wrestling is because your mom told you to. Mm-hmm. What did she say?
Well, don't you listen to your parents, you know, when they tell you something? Don't you do it? Well, not everybody, but and I didn't do it every time either. But I could remember that when my dad or my dad was there for support, unbelievably, provided a lot of stuff. But my mom's the one that gave me these lectures. And so these lectures turned out pretty well in my life. And who knows better than your mom? So she's been with you a long time. So it was like they were trying to talk me into maybe going for another four-year stint. I was pretty young. I was younger than most wrestlers. So I was 23 when I won the Olympic gold. And so I was back home and visiting, and I was over to the high school working out. I came in, and she looks at me, and she sees me. I got a black eye that day again. I'm hardly walking. I got a sprained ankle, which is pretty normal.
Right.
And she just said, you know, Dan, it's time to move on. I don't think you should be staying in this sport as a competitor. You got to get on and make some money and coach. And yeah, she was right. So I needed to move on with my life. And so that's what I did. So, and then when I was about 49 and pretty much beat up again as a coach.
Right. But you were a very, very physical coach.
Right. Even if I didn't wrestle during practice, I would wrestle after practice just because that was why I loved it. And that's what I get my exercise. And so all of a sudden, just one day I woke up and jumped out of bed and pretty much done walking without getting some major reconstruction done. It was done. And so at that time, I had to make another decision, and my mom had already passed on, and I just went back to her and asked her. And she kind of told me, she did tell me that time to move on again in your life. Yeah. You've had enough of that. And it's and so I moved on another aspect, more promotion of the sport, and, you know, and really making sure that it's around. And we almost lost it with the Olympics here shortly. Yeah. And because I can devote full time to it, we're going to have it strong in the future.
Dan Gable, thank you so much.
Thank you.
What a pleasure. Dan Gable, there are so many more stories we could have talked about. He has shared his stories in the new book, A Wrestling Life, The Inspiring Stories of Dan Gable, co-written with Scott Schulte. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbie.